Welcome to the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. This is a place where radical ideas and methods are discussed in the quest towards freedom making. It is a space to dialogue, share, and learn about revolutionary politics, political struggles, radical solidarities, cultural resistance, healing justice, and is a crossing to unearth legacies of resistance pedagogies, global radicalism, and internationalism. I'm your host, Chani Desai, and if you like this episode, please subscribe. Hi. In today's episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast, our guest is Hisham Safidine, who's joining us from Lebanon. Hisham is assistant professor in the history of the modern Middle East at King's College London in the UK. He is the author of Banking on the State, The Financial Foundations of Lebanon, is the co-editor of The Clarion of Syria, and is the editor of the forthcoming book Mahdi Amil, Arab Marxism and National Liberation, Selected Writings. Hisham is also co-founder of the e-zines Al-Akhbar English and the Legal Agenda's English edition. His public writings have appeared in the Toronto Star, Al Jazeera English, The Monthly Review, Al-Adab, Middle East Eye, Egypt Independent, Jadalia, Al Haram Weekly, Asafir, and Le Monde Diplomatique. Hisham, thank you so much for being with us today, especially during this devastating time. I hope you're safe, whatever that even means these days, and that you're staying steadfast in these uncertain and tumultuous times.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be on your program, and I very much look forward to having a informative conversation. I myself, I'm safe and well, and in steadfast, as you say, and hoping to do whatever I can, the little I can, to support everyone who's going through this, and to hopefully also share my thoughts on what's taking place with people outside of Lebanon who may be unable, perhaps, to necessarily access what's taking place on the ground and politically because of all sorts of ways in which media, the mainstream media and other also media sources are depicting the current situation. So it's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me, and I'm ready to hopefully have a great conversation.
Okay, so before delving into our conversation, I'm going to just provide listeners with a very brief context of what is happening there. So on August 4th, 2020, a massive explosion caused by 2,750 tons of an ammonium nitrate stored in Beirut's port shook Beirut, obliterated most of the port and parts of the capital city, killing more than 200 people, injuring 6,000, destroying hundreds of buildings, including the major grain silo reserves and medicine reserves, which are direly needed amid the COVID-19 pandemic, and dozens of people are still missing. The explosion has caused extensive infrastructure damage, which is estimated to about $15 billion. Of course, that could not be accurate. And has also approximately left 300,000 people homeless and many health facilities, including hospitals, inoperable. The port's destruction is of significance because Lebanon heavily depends on imports, including much of its food. Also, this explosion has fueled tremendous outrage and has revitalized the Lebanese protest movement against the criminal negligence of the political class of Lebanon. The explosion was the last straw in a protracted crisis over the collapse of the economy, rampant corruption, and the dysfunctional government. Though Lebanese Prime Minister Hassan Diab's cabinet resigned on August 10th after significant pressure from the streets, many, particularly progressives, want to see an end to the political sectarian system that has bankrupted Lebanon preceding this explosion. So Hisham, I want to begin by asking you if you can explain to listeners what the economic crisis that preceded this explosion looked like, specifically the causes that led to the financial collapse.
So Lebanon has been facing a severe financial and economic crisis starting in October of last year. And there are fundamental structural roots to the crisis, and then there were triggers that happened in the last few years. So structurally speaking, Lebanon's economy is extremely unbalanced. It is highly dependent, as you've mentioned, on imports. it does not have a agricultural sector, barely. It's 6 to 8% of its economy is agricultural. Also, it doesn't have any significant industry. We're talking about, again, estimates vary, but between 15 to 20%. And everything else is about tourism and services, and mainly banking. So now, historically, although Lebanon has always had a trade deficit, so it's always imported more than exported, it always found ways to attract capital, to attract money to its economy, and mostly through either remittances, because Lebanon has a very large diaspora, or through a banking system that provided banking secrecy, and at times provided high interest rates. So it wasn't a, this money was not used for productive investments. It was mostly, it's an offshore-like place where you put your money and you either get a lot of interest or in, as I mentioned, remittances. So this system that was sustained for so long always had crises. It's not the first time it meets a serious problem. But what happened to this in the last few years is you had, on top of this crisis, you also had a government budget crisis. The sovereign debt of Lebanon, historically did not borrow a lot of, the government did not borrow a lot of money. It was a very austere type government. Started borrowing heavily after the civil war in 1990 and it accumulated a large debt. So eventually the local banks were lending the government, using the depositors' money to fund an extremely corrupt political class and to gain high revenues through the interest. So this couldn't be sustained because it's, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, is some sort of a Ponzi scheme where, you know, you were borrowing from people, lending the government was spending them the wrong places. So all of this came together and blew up in the face of people when the banks could not anymore sustain themselves because they weren't able to pay money anymore. There was also a decline in tourism in Lebanon. There's a decline in remittances because of many factors, including the global recession. Many Lebanese who live in the Gulf could not anymore send money. The Lebanese community in West Africa is under attack by the American administration. So a lot of sanctions, financial sanctions, were put in place to prevent the money from coming to Lebanon. So all of these factors came together. And there was a flight, there was capital flight from Lebanon in the last year or so. So billions of dollars were being leaving the country because of political uncertainty. Some people argue it's possibly part of also an attempt to undermine the Lebanese economy because the Lebanese government was increasingly seen as closer to Hezbollah. So all of these factors came together and the Lebanese lobby, banking lobby also prevented any serious reforms. And we have this financial crisis. The second, another important point to keep in mind, Lebanon had a pegged currency, which meant that the Lebanese currency was pegged, tied to the dollar. So Lebanon's economy was highly dollarized, which meant, and part of the debt, the Lebanese debt, was also in US dollars. So the government cannot pay its debt by simply printing money. So this is all came also amidst the Syrian crisis, and the global conflict over reconstruction in Syria, over the shift towards the Chinese economy. So hot capital, capital that comes into countries simply because of interest rates that doesn't have any long-term interest is also can easily leave. So this is where we find ourselves, where people can't get their lifetime savings from the banks. And this is when, basically an uprising, well, I mean, the stoppage of payment happened a little bit after, but the point is that all of this came together and blew up and we found ourselves in this crisis.
So how has or will this explosion exacerbate both the economic and political crisis even further? And what could that materially look like on the ground?
So if this couldn't have come at the worst time, because again, the Lebanese economy is based on banks and imports. So the banks are in crisis, and now the port is in crisis. So this is going to drastically reduce the country's ability to import much needed food, medical supplies, other goods, There are two other ports in the country that also operate and allow possibly for relieving some of the stress, particularly the port in Tripoli in the north. So on top of the human loss, on top of the destruction of sections of Beirut, this is going to actually exacerbate and speed up potentially, you know, the further impoverishment of the Lebanese population. It might also fuel further inflation. We also, Lebanon imports a lot of its energy fuel. It doesn't have oil. So that also is going to be reduced. There are people saying that the Tripoli port can handle a lot of this, but still we have to talk about the fact that much of the economic activity takes place in Mount Lebanon and near Beirut. You have transportation costs. So this is a gradual process, not going to happen very quickly. So yeah, this is a big hit to the economy. And also the Beirut port is the main port of entry for goods that go to Syria. Particularly the regions of Syria that lie under the Syrian regime. So there's a port war also going on in the region, which is tied to the Belt and Road Initiative. China has expressed interest in the past in expanding the Tripoli port and also the Beirut port. We know that the apartheid regime is also expanding the Haifa port. There's also struggle over the oil, the gas reserves in the East Mediterranean. So Beirut also acts as a transit port for many ships that are going down through the Suez Canal. So there's a regional implication to this as well.
Yes, this is a really important reminder of the way in which ports and the business of international marine capital operate and work. And so I think as we're thinking about capitalism internationally, I want to actually segue into the relationship of foreign intervention to capital. So last week, French President Emmanuel Macron arrived in Beirut shortly after the blast, making promises to rebuild the city, and said that, I quote, "France will never let Lebanon go," end quote. We know that French companies have had a long presence in Lebanon with ties to Macron and will potentially be given contracts for the reconstruction of Beirut, along potentially with other foreign conglomerates. Additionally, yesterday, UK warship HMS Enterprise just docked the port while the French Navy helicopter carried trained infantry soldiers and made their way to Beirut. So it's very clear that the explosion is prompting foreign intervention quite quickly, which we know from history will capitalize and profit off of this tragedy, what Naomi Klein has called disaster capitalism, and will also potentially try to alter the political landscape to serve their interests. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on this and other possible forms of foreign intervention, and what would be at stake for Lebanon economically and politically if foreign intervention were to take place.
So this question has many levels. I'm going to start by speaking generally about foreign intervention and then speak about the political implications of Macron's visit. When we discuss foreign intervention, unfortunately today, particularly in Western circles, people who are abroad, anytime you do, and sometimes also this happens here in Lebanon, Syria, anytime you discuss this, if you are opposed to foreign intervention, you are immediately described as a supporter of dictatorial regimes, which is something I vehemently would oppose. And anytime you call for foreign intervention, rather than discuss about what that means, you're just dismissed as an imperialist. And in many instances, those who are opposing foreign intervention are not interested in anti-dictatorial transformation. And those who are calling for foreign intervention could care less about imperialism. So this is a stalemate. This is a very bad place for people who believe, who are anti-imperialists and socialists or progressives to be in. And sometimes it actually creates a chilling effect. Right. People are scared of talking about it.
Yeah.
Personally, I'm not. And I'm going to speak about it without any reservation. And people can make their own conclusions. And the way I think for us to speak about it is to be more precise, more concise, to also be sensitive to the suffering that people are facing without using that suffering to silence political conversation. That is the difference. If an individual person is facing, you know, immediate suffering and they're expressing themselves, that's totally fine. When we talk about the future of peoples, when we talk about, you know, the implications of war, when we talk about the, we cannot but talk about what this means, you know, otherwise we're just, you know, playing on emotions and we're misleading people. So with that introduction in mind, let me say that Lebanon has always been a site of war intervention. So anybody who comes and says today, we want the world to intervene, that is a meaningless statement. The world has been intervening in Lebanon since its very creation. And they've been intervening in very direct and tangible ways, whether they are the direct patrons of factions of the ruling class, whether they intervene economically. For instance, how can you ask for aid, for foreign aid, from countries that are imposing sanctions on you?
Right.
I mean, you should, if you're interested in the world, in calling on the world to help, then you should start by calling for an end to military presence in the region. You should start calling for an end to sanctions. So another angle that's now very present in Lebanon is, this is the logic of some of the activists. Okay, the ruling elite is so corrupt that we therefore appeal to foreign governments to provide aid and help directly to the Lebanese people to circumvent the ruling class and these elites. Now, to begin with, many of these, if this is about social justice and this is about change, and so I'm not talking about immediate relief. I think immediate relief, there are mechanisms to do it through the Red Cross, to the UN. You know, obviously, if people are dying on the street and you want to give them aid, that's, I'm not talking about that. And I would much prefer that non-governmental groups who are capable of doing that to do so. But I also understand that the scale of the destruction sometimes might require. And as a matter of fact, we already have had loads. Many countries have already provided a lot of aid. People focus on the Western governments, but they did. The Gulf states did. Iran did. China did. Turkey did, so everybody did. So fine, this is what's needed on the ground. That's good. But when we talk about reconstruction, when we talk about providing potentially money for new developmental projects to help Lebanon, when we talk about potentially alleviating the financial crisis. So in this case, I would first point out that many of these governments themselves are not legitimate because of the way they treat either their people. For example, the idea of calling on Trudeau, because you're in Canada, to actually provide aid directly to the Lebanese people, I find that an insult. And first to the indigenous peoples of the Canada, and also for the Lebanese people, because Trudeau has also supported Israel, which actually destroyed large sections of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. So this is about national dignity. This is about, not everything is just about, as we know from even, thou shalt not live with bread alone. So this is what I'm trying to say. If you want to, if your goal is to punish this elite, you need to do it in a manner that restores national sovereignty, doesn't further erode it. Otherwise, you're going to replace those elites with this international corrupt imperialist class that is going to simply exploit the resources that exist, that will definitely push for further social division. So this is my problem with people who are calling for direct aid without calling for an end to sanctions. Another example, rather than calling for aid, why don't you call for the return of stolen assets? Why don't you call for these governments to return the assets that were actually smuggled out of Lebanon during these 2 years? And this is where we come to the Macron visit. So Macron's, first of all, we have to understand the visit of Macron in the regional context. There is now there's tension now between France and Turkey over Libya. Mm-hmm. There's also some disagreement between the United States and France over what to do in Libya along the same lines. So Macron's visit and attempt to potentially facilitate a political solution is part of this negotiating game between these powers. So we cannot simply take it out of that context. That's number one. Number two, this is a president who's extremely unpopular in his own country. He wouldn't be able to come down in Paris and walk through. And then he's coming and performing this kind of act of kindness among those whose homes were destroyed. And in this case, there's an additional layer of a colonial history, because Lebanon was a colonial, was colonized by the French and occupied. And we still have sections of the Lebanese population who still have affinity to the Lebanese. Macron himself actually explicitly said that part of the aid might be to fund Francophone schools. So this is where you have soft power. So we have to understand also intervention, not in simple, superficial imperialist slogans. There is soft power. There's an attempt by France, as tiny as France is compared to China or the United States. But in the Mediterranean, they do have influence. And there's a whole history of missionaries in Lebanon. Missionaries, if you really want to rebuild the country, you fund national education. You don't go and fund Francophone schools. You don't support the institutional Maronite church. And in this case, I would also say any other organized religious institution like Dar al-Fatwa or Majlis al-Shia al-A'la, the Shia Council. Or the... So these are institutions that actually are part of the sectarian fabric.
Right.
So the idea that Macron is going to bring, you know, some modern change to Lebanon, in fact, he's doing the exact opposite. He's reinforcing these sectarian affiliations. The last point I want to make about Macron's visit, actually, maybe I'll make a couple more points. Maybe I'll share, if you're interested, I can tell the viewers about the political solution he's trying to propose. But people should remember or know that the financial crisis, as I mentioned, was a result of chronic sovereign or public debt. And it was a result of the refinancing of the debt. And as a matter of fact, since the mid to late 1990s, France has been the major sponsor of the refinancing of Lebanon's debt. So all the conferences that were called Friends of Lebanon conferences, at which the debt was rolled over, was held in Paris, and they're called Paris 1, Paris 2, Paris 3. And the last one, which was called Paris 4, but they changed the name because people stopped believing in these conferences. They called it CEDR, Cedar Conference, at which the donors pledged $10 billion. And this is when they did not dispense much of the money recently. So this tap, this constant tap of money that was coming in, was part of the problem. And they were hosting these sectarian leaders, these businessmen,
right,
in France. So you cannot think of Macron all of a sudden as actually the person who's going to facilitate a transition into a non-sectarian government. And here, to finish my intervention, Macron now is trying to create a national government in which all these factions, political factions in power, again, rearrange their power-sharing situation, in which they reconfigure their power-sharing arrangement, and they shift a little bit of the weight of the power from the camp that is the Hezbollah and Aounist camp to the so-called March 14 camp under potentially Hariri patronage, the son of the godfather of Lebanon's economic system. So it's very clear to me that this is not an attempt to save Lebanon. There may be some aid coming in. Even at the international conference, the pledge is around $250 to $300 million, which is a drop in the bucket compared to how much Lebanon needs or compared to the financial resources of the countries involved. We're seeing a campaign to portray Lebanon as helpless, portray Lebanon as... you know, the typical charity approach that
we savior, the savior mentality.
Savior and the idea of the beggar mentality. You know, exactly, the savior. So the same way we hear about how, you know, sub-Saharan African countries need the help of the white man, we are hearing, and so unfortunately people sometimes here are playing into this. So you have all these expressions of, you know, suffering, which to me is horrendous because it is the instrumentalization of suffering. And there's a big distinction between a dignified way of describing the suffering, of turning the suffering into anger, into action, and between trying to basically, you know, extend your hands and ask for some form of, so it's the pauperization of politics, if I can use that term. And last but not least is, you've mentioned the Naomi Klein shock doctrine, the economic, the interest. So I'm not sure, I mean, yes, there is possibly, if France is going to spearhead the reconstruction, it's likely that the French companies will have a say in some of these projects. But also we do have other contenders, including Chinese companies and other companies. So we might see another, and I hope not, Solidaire, which is the company that was used to reconstruct the downtown area. So we do have vulture capital waiting to kind of, you know, use that. But it's also, it's too early to figure out who's going to eventually get the largest piece of the pie.
Right. And while it's too early to tell how this is going to play out and who is going to ultimately benefit, I'm just wondering what conditions you think will be required both politically and economically to rebuild the city, and perhaps what actors would be participating in the reconstruction of Beirut. And also, where would the capital come from, given Lebanon's economic crisis and the high debt? Where would this money come from in order to rebuild that all of that which has been damaged, specifically the infrastructure?
Under the current conditions, obviously, we don't have a... So let me start by saying that the reconstruction is a symptom, it's not the cause. So I don't think we should start with the reconstruction. We really have to start with political change. Mm-hmm. Because any reconstruction that takes place, even if we have private companies, I don't think anybody has any illusion that in those days, well, we're not in the era of the Soviet Union or, you know, private capital is very likely to have a role in this. But the question is, how does it take place? Is it going to happen on an individual basis with each? So if we have a strong state and if we have proper regulatory measures and we have some type of fund that is used dedicated to reconstructing people's homes and potentially having some sort of partnership to reconstruct the port, the money question becomes kind of secondary. It's about preserving the ownership structure, making sure that the port doesn't become, you know, privatized.
Private, yeah.
That's key. Making sure that the old neighborhoods of Beirut that were destroyed and that people's homes and the tenants who are there retain their rights to live in those regions so we don't see a displacement of these people. So all of these things, you start there by putting all these conditions. And then you find out a way, hopefully, to potentially attract investment. So the framework is missing, and without a responsible government, which we don't have at the moment, I'm not sure. It might be hodgepodge, or it might be, again, a foreign patron who is kind of, I mean, the way it happens in Lebanon, either you have international consensus or some form of it in which a particular foreign actor is delegated that role. So that can be somebody, you know, France, it can be sometimes even Syria, historically, Saudi Arabia. So I don't know what is the formula that they will kind of settle on. And it can be, by the way, potentially multilateral. Mm-hmm. So with the IMF maybe leading, or I have no idea, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's hard to speculate.
Of course.
So the point is, once this framework is in place, if you don't have a responsible government, obviously they're going to seek very lax conditions.
Right.
So the key here to me is, and I even, you know, I went and walked through the debris in the second day. I wasn't there the first day. You know, so much of the cleanup is happening by communities.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And I understand, you know, celebrating solidarity between people, but my point, and not just my point, many people would say, or some people would say, you know, clean your homes, but we shouldn't also do the job of the state.
Of course.
And because not just the state, you might have contractors tomorrow come in. You've done the labor for them. You've cleaned the streets and they're ready to just pick up the debris. So this is a political crisis.
It's
the economic aspect of it is a symptom, and the focus needs to be on politics. And maybe here where we can have a bit of a discussion about, you know, what are the alternatives or...
That's where I'm going. So on August 7th, thousands demonstrated with rage against the government, calling out the criminal negligence and asking for accountability for this devastation, but also outrage at the absence of the state, what you just, you know, mentioned in terms of their presence at a time where people are in complete shock and also homes and businesses have been destroyed. And the current rebellions also build upon the October 2019 uprisings or revolution. At that time, people were fed up with, again, the economy, high taxes, unemployment, crumbling infrastructure, and rampant corruption, which thrived under Lebanon's sectarian political system. And of course, though this prime minister and his cabinet have resigned, many are calling for the dismantling of the political system. Do you think it's likely to dismantle the current sectarian political system? And if yes, what alternatives do leftists and progressives hope to build?
So first I should clarify, maybe when I spoke, potentially misspoke. No, the state structures are there and the state apparatus is there. So it's not that there's, because some people are using this term, the absence of the state. It's the bad government.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that, yeah. And I,
non-institutions, that's what I meant too.
And I'm correcting myself because I also initially said that. So because again, people can misunderstand what both of us are saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there is also a trend, as you know, that, you know, we don't have states in the global south, they're weak states. Even when we say bad government, people will only go through the question of corruption. What can we do? We live in a world where culturally the hegemonic discourse is the imperialist discourse, and we have to constantly remind ourselves of that. So it's fine if we sometimes, you know, misuse or misappropriate these terms, but I ask the listeners to be kind for us.
Yes, please
so,
be kind.
So to go back to your question, firstly, I should point out that the demonstration, and here I'm speaking because I think it's very important. Part of my, you know, as somebody who upholds socialist values, I sometimes struggle to convince many people who think the same way I do, for us to measure things in a realistic way. This is independent of what we would like to see or what we want to fight for. It's very crucial. So the first point I want to make is the demonstrations on the August the 7th, they were large. They were definitely large, but they were nowhere near what happened in October 17th.
Mm-hmm.
So any attempt to portray this as another October 17 is a misrepresentation of what took place. There may be many reasons why people didn't come. It could be because of the explosion itself, you know, had left people unable to move, mobilize. But also we have to admit that there is a disillusionment among large sections of the population, that many people who went down on October 17 have reverted to their sectarian, you know, allegiance, or they found that if they don't do that, they're at risk of even more precarity. That's the first point. The second point is there was also a dominant discourse, at least the one being reported on the media, local media and otherwise, of, again, and here we come to another sticky issue that anytime we talk about this issue, people are immediately dismissed or attacked, which is Hezbollah. So I'll give you an example. So there was an anti-Hezbollah rhetoric in many aspects of this movement. I'm not here generalizing, but I was following minute to minute what people were saying on TV, on camera, the visible, that's what I'm talking about, who were visible in this demonstration. So for instance, there was a takeover of the Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And
I
people
saw
were celebrating, you know, which is great. Mm-hmm. But then you look at the first banner that was hurled down on the book was that they want an arms-free Beirut.
Right, a demilitarized Beirut.
Yeah, but this is, of course, they thought, the people who were leading this were the retired generals, this was a demand by Macron.
Mm-hmm.
So you want sovereignty, but then you do the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You're concerned about internal sovereignty via Hezbollah, But then you're not concerned about being basically a protectorate of a foreign country.
Right.
And also, they immediately withdrew at the earliest threat. So here I'm not, again, I have some friends, dear friends, who were present there. I want to emphasize this is about, not about emotions, not about motivation, not about good intentions. And we'll get to the crux of the problem, which is organization. But my point here is, this point, not only is it divisive, people have to take a stance. What is your starting point? You cannot simply discuss Hezbollah like that. Either you say, I support and legitimate any arms based on its use. And this is where I judge Hezbollah based on what it's using it for. Mm-hmm. So this means you can have a different opinion about what's happening in Yemen and Syria versus South Lebanon. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you're not going to do that, and all you're going to do is just attack Hezbollah, then you are simply playing into the narrative of the American and Israeli agenda.
Agreed.
And also, you don't control the message. People have to understand that. So they get excited. They're on CNN. They're writing in I don't know what. You know. So this is another point I want to say. Mainstream media. You have somebody, and I don't mind. I'm going to analyze this. I rarely do this, but it's fine. I'm comfortable with it. You have someone like, you know, the correspondent of The Guardian, Martin Chulov. He just writes an article. Three times he mentions Hezbollah. He uses the word defang to talk about it. Not a word about Israeli occupation or apartheid, or how does he envision if we don't have, you know, this is how there is this current, this, in my view, very negative current. Someone who, by the way, doesn't know the difference between the name of one of the leaders of Hezbollah and myself. He confused them at some point. So you have somebody like that, or who quotes a quasi-warlord in Tripoli, Safifi, as being part of the movement. So you have these, you know, these foreign journalists as well who, again, are feeding into this conversation. So for me, you stick with the basics. You have a threat, a constant threat of Israeli aggression. You also have this, by the way, on the other hand, you can't use that to suppress the legitimate demands of people. So Hezbollah bears a responsibility as part of the political class who rules Lebanon.
Completely.
They bear an equal responsibility. No one should exonerate them. Mm-hmm. But much of the opposition is not about that. Mm-hmm. It is about the only issue potentially that, in my view, people should potentially support in, you know, what comes to South Lebanon. When it comes to Syria, there's all sorts of contradictions we can talk about. So my point is, there's a way whereby you can don't have to legitimate or accept the excuses used by Hezbollah. And Hezbollah has used also this card to justify its inability or sometimes complicity in corruption. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this kind of conversation we're having, most people either don't want to have or the media doesn't have, you know, the wherewithal to accept this nuanced argument. You know, people, because also it won't make you popular. You're not going to be popular. You're not going to be shared on social media. You're not going to be, you know, hailed as the great savior of the left or whatever. So some of this is so immature. Completely immature, you know, and it's about scoring points, and also it's about parochialism. So if you are supporting the Syrian uprising, you don't give a shit about the implications of disarming Hezbollah in the south. If you are in the South Lebanon, you could care less if Hezbollah killed so many Syrians, because you just want to protect South Lebanon. So either you actually look at the big picture and say, we have to stand in solidarity together. We have to find a solution to this question as a region, because Lebanon is a small country, whether the people like it or not, you know? So the idea again of Lebanon healing its wounds on its own is also ridiculous. But the question is, what kind of solidarity you can create to avoid Lebanon either remaining under the mercy of these criminal warlords and capitalists, or at the mercy of foreign powers. And this is why, sorry if I kind of going too long.
No.
I'll give you an example. 200 people dead. You know their nationalities. How many of them are Syrians? There are 40 of them. Most of the Lebanese media is talking about the wife of the Dutch embassy.
Right.
And I send my condolences to her family. But how come, what happened to the solidarity with the Syrians? There is still anti-Syrian sentiment in the same regions that were destroyed. So again, my point here is, There's one thing about alleviating the immediate suffering, which we should all do. But if you're going to talk about how this moment is a transformative moment, we have to take into account these issues and the question of political organization, which we can talk about.
Well, I guess, I mean, since we're on the topic of solidarity, I mean, I think it's a really important question, because sometimes, you know, and I mean, it seems kind of schizophrenic that, you know, Lebanese diaspora communities are in solidarity with themselves, but in a sense, because of the fact that they're not there, they are extending or sending solidarity or organizing, sometimes relief efforts, but sometimes are also organizing political efforts, right? In the respective countries and spaces they're in addition to leftist movements. And I'm just wondering what forms or acts of solidarity might be useful at this time. But I'm asking for that in a critical way, because I think that it's important that that solidarity is not co-opted, like you've talked about earlier, around the agendas of Western imperialist powers and the aid regime, and especially those that are doing solidarity in the West. And I think the reason I bring that this up, and I guess it also translates to the context within doing political organizing there, but the reason I ask this is because sometimes you do witness these contradictions, as you mentioned, that, you know, one might go to the Canadian state for a very specific kind of intervention when that very government is complicit in the indigenous genocide of the people here, or you go to the US when the US is complicit in so many forms of violence and also imperialist aggression elsewhere. So I'm really curious about how you're thinking about, you know, solidarity in this moment, and what might be useful.
I think this question is there's no one formula. Each community and each country should think about what is their relationship to Lebanon or any other country they want to express solidarity with. Mm. And it's preferable to start the conversation with the communities of that country in that, you know, you do want to have a conversation. There are people, Lebanese people everywhere, that are doing incredible work and are extremely devoted and dedicated to supporting the Lebanese here. That doesn't mean that some of the politics of those communities reflect the politics of Lebanon. That's quite natural. So whether it's a sectarian division, whether it is potentially the sense of cultural affinity to the West, which you may not find within other communities, although this unfortunately has also changed in some Arab communities in the West. So my first point would be, this is something for these communities to decide in their own place. But I would say there are certain general rules of thumb. So the first rule of thumb is, you're speaking truth to power. So think about the power structures where you are and do not dismiss those, and simply think about the local structure where you're trying to support. Because at the end of the day, you are speaking to the communities you belong to over there. So the first point is, think about these power structures where you are and the implications they have. The second, I would say, think about the ways in which the power relations that exist between you and the states and the governments you are dealing with. I'm not, again, opposed in an absolute manner. I mean, I'm part of an initiative to try to bring back the money from Switzerland, but within certain conditions and rules. And I have no illusion about, for example, how much stronger this Swiss state is to me or to my group. So don't just get overexcited about being visible, about be very careful about being instrumentalized in mainstream media. I think one of the CNN anchors, and forgive me, I don't know Rebecca, she's been so active in the case of Lebanon, and I find her tears to be crocodile tears, and people get excited about being on the show and stuff. So my point is to say, be very cognizant of how much you can influence your state and regulate its aid versus you're going to be a tool by the state. This is why you need to also focus on people's demands. And again, you know, focus on how you can put your government accountable, not appealing to your government to help another, especially in a neo-colonial context. So those are the key things. And if there are problems, or there are divergent views, don't shy away, in my view, from speaking to the communities that are active in a very kind of share your thoughts. You know, again, this is demanding political maturity. And I find, because of social media, because of the way politics is done today, because of this individualism that people, you know, it's either me or nobody. If this is my view, that's it. If you like it, we're in solidarity. If we don't, we're not. So you need to create spaces, make it gradual. And this is where it has to be sometimes done behind closed doors. And I don't mean to be, this is not about exclusion. It's about, maybe the term is not the best, but it has to be very transparent, but it has to be community to community outside of the realm of media and public activism. You know, that's how you build it first. So, but these are general guidelines. The specifics of the message you want or what you're going to demand needs to be negotiated in a way that addresses and balances. It's a fine balance between some of the urgent demands and how these communities think, and you know, the ways in which some of these activists or solidarity groups that have been working for so long in these countries think. So I think those are the main things to think about and keep in mind when you do it.
Okay. I actually want to go back to another question that takes us a little bit backwards into the conversation when we're talking about the political system. There have been a lot of people saying that Lebanon might be on the brink of a civil war, given that parties are sort of using or they're threatening each other. Do you think that that is possible?
Well, I mean, you know, never say never, not just as a politician, but as a historian. Mm-hmm. It's always possible. The question, of course, is it probable? And today, the material conditions for a civil war are not there yet. So the most powerful group, armed group in the country, which is Hezbollah, does not have the intention of seeking civil war. And the other party, which may have the intention, does not have so far the means or the organization or the capability. So structurally speaking, we don't have the conditions to create civil war. We have the conditions for the further erosion of some form of law and order. We have the condition of potential, maybe bombings, maybe to destabilize the situation, maybe some form of strife and skirmishes within certain neighborhoods, occasional flurries of violence that can happen. But when we talk about civil war, we're talking about a large-scale war. And the last time this happened in Lebanon was in 1975. And you had two parties. You had the right-wing fascist party, which was funded, armed by Israel, and had all the intention for war. And you had another party, which is the National Movement, which had the Palestinian Liberation Movement in its back. And it has its also arms, and there was also money that was available for both parties to fund their war. And there was also an ideological split that was extremely hard. So for that to happen, we need to see potentially, for example, the only party that can potentially be involved now in an armed conflict other than Hezbollah is the army. And the Americans have been funding the army for a while now. But the army still is not properly trained for this kind of war. So also the army is composed of different sects, so it might lead to factionalism within the army. But this can create havoc if it happens. And this is potentially what the Israelis or the Americans would like. So it's possible. But a civil war, you know, again, in the near future, I find it unlikely. Although, again, I cannot rule it out because, for example, this explosion on its own is so impactful that, you know, what I'm trying to say is the condition today, you know, if the civil war requires a decision, preparation, and this takes time. So if we have a civil war, again, part of this civil war narrative is this over-dramatization of things, which I think is so counterproductive. And sometimes it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it can be an excuse for intervention. It can be an excuse for incitement. So there's going to be civil war, let's go and get arms. So we have so much war going on around us that it's possible that we can, you know, maybe there is a serious scenario being prepared for Lebanon. I'm not saying there isn't. All I'm saying is, at the moment, if it happens, it's going to take some time for any. So without direct intervention by Israel, by Syria or somebody else, the local actors, there's only one actor that is powerful militarily. Mm-hmm. That actor today is not seeking war internally. So this is why, to me, whatever the other, you know, conditions, unless those conditions are met, maybe, you know, by next year, I find the civil war scenario, again, without a clear regional war, for example, or some clear foreign intervention, is so far unlikely. But we might have, you know, skirmishes, we might have certain, a resurgence of what happened, for example, in 2008. There was actually a kind of few days of armed conflict, after which there was a new political arrangement. So there might be something like that. I don't know. But civil war like 1958 or 1975, at the moment, it's not, you know, this is my analysis. I could be proven wrong, but this is what I think the situation.
I'm going to steer us away now in another direction. One will be the imaginary and the other is just a teaching, because you're also a teacher. I'm wondering, when you're teaching about these issues in the classroom, what are some effective strategies that help people or help the students really grasp what's going on there, or help them develop a consciousness that can help them act? So is there anything pedagogically that you specifically, you know, a teaching approach that you use or that you engage with as a way to raise political consciousness about the region with students?
When it comes to classroom pedagogy, I know that you yourself have amazing techniques and you're extremely successful in your ability to blend, and I use this word with no pun intended when it comes to the new blended online learning techniques that the administrations of universities are trying to impose on us. So I think you're potentially in a much better position to share your vision and your roadmap. But on my end, first, I think a lot of my teaching is historical. So classroom pedagogy, to me, I do make a distinction between how I teach in the classroom and how I engage with generally public debate. Because I believe that in the classroom, yes, one has to create a political consciousness, but I don't believe that the classroom is a place necessary for political mobilization. So I think I want to make a distinction between the two. And so that means that the classroom is an incredibly important opportunity to discuss things without reservation, to take on the side of the oppressor sometimes in terms of analysis, to understand the logic, that's what I mean. To understand the logic of the oppressors, to dig deep and give even, you know, I'll give an example. I teach on Zionism. You know, I'm much more tolerant of all sorts of opinions about Zionism in the classroom because it's an opportunity to allow people to debate. Also, I am aware of my power dynamic. I have a certain function. So in terms of, you know, techniques of increasing political consciousness, the first thing I would say is, again, use this as an opportunity to understand before you, so whatever your political views are, try your best not to project them immediately, start from the ground up, much more systematically. The second, I'd say I'm much more systematic when I teach. So I'm less likely potentially to engage in polemics against a president or a prime minister. I really focus on fundamentals of conflict because students are not going to get that when they do activism necessarily or when they watch the media. So I use the classroom as really what historically would be called tathqif, hizbi, which means party ideological education. This is where maybe not. Maybe in certain political parties you don't do that. But so my point is that I do. This is my approach. I also, when it comes to topics to write, I'm a lot more open to pushing students to do what they're mostly interested in, as opposed to what is most urgent when it comes to the struggle. So, you know, I let them because they can really come out with amazing work if they do that. Also, I do incorporate news into my teaching, so people do get to, students can be overwhelmed, particularly if they're not familiar with the politics of the region. So I ask them to be patient. I ask them to potentially, you know, focus on one aspect and deepen their knowledge in one area. They don't have to feel that they need to know everything at this point in time. Language is another thing. I encourage them, if they want to be involved long-term in any place, to get to know the language of the country. I understand that you can still have very deep understandings of the conflict without the language. But again, this is another aspect. So it depends on how much they want to be involved. And it's not an easy thing, but that's another thing I talk to them about. Basically, creating knowledge and passing on knowledge in a kind of critical and you know, one-on-one type thing, which some students today appreciate because it's really absent from their lives.
So Hisham, I want to close with a question on the imaginary. What is your vision of liberation for Lebanon and the region more broadly?
Well, I think I would very much like the vision to be a collective vision, a vision that is imagined and executed, hopefully, by political forces under which all sorts of people who believe in social justice, who believe in national liberation, who believe in basic equality, who believe in a society that is free from sectarianism in the case of Lebanon. So my vision would be maybe it's there's three pillars, three basic pillars to it. The first is an end to Zionist settler colonialism. So that's a basic requirement. That's a basic demand also of the peoples of this region. The second would be an end to the dictatorial regimes and their allies, both reactionary forces within these countries and foreign governments who are supporting them. So an end to dictatorship, also an end to foreign military occupation, to the wars that are being played out in the region, and a vision in which we have the demands of the people for public health care, free education, gender equality that is also free from colonial feminism. So all sorts of these basically socialist ideals that people believe in, except of course, we have to think of them in relation to the context of each region. This is not simply an internationalist linear or flat vision. It has to be linked to the struggles and suffering of the people of the region. So in the case of particularly Iraq, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, and Jordan, I do believe that any such vision has to think about solidarity and common cause, not just solidarity, I would say, to rethink their struggle in relation to each other. And, you know, what happened in Syria is proof that we cannot isolate the Syrian uprising from what's happening in Lebanon. We cannot isolate what's happening in Lebanon from what's happening in Palestine and vice versa. So in the midst of a global war, geopolitical war between big players, and in the midst of the shift from west to east, economically, globally, I hope and I really think that any political work, movement that is, you know, focused on revolutionizing social relations in this region has to be regional. It cannot be simply in each country separately. So these are big, of course, big hopes, but one can only struggle to get to at least, you know, some of them, or hopefully one day all of them.
Well, you know, as Robin Kelly tells us that, you know, it's really important for us to not just be in the streets to take things down, but we also have to dream these freedom dreams, to imagine what we're going to build. Because if we don't have this imaginary, what are we working towards, right? So it's not just what we are against, but also what are we for? And so I think, yes, it's a big vision, but I also think it's from these visionaries and imaginaries that you actually can materialize action, you know?
I think the question of fighting for something, not simply against something, is so crucial and so absent in many, including in the case of Lebanon. And when we talk about the imaginary, I think there is also, we have to admit that, because a lot of times I hear that, but when it comes to a concrete vision, it's a lot of times lacking. And part of it, I think, is the era we're living in. Because we do have a collapse of the communist world, and we have a failure of the capitalist world.
Right.
So people, you know, people are struggling. They, I think we shouldn't also just self-congratulate ourselves or think that, my point is there is a serious dilemma. Of what is the framework that humanity and people in general can fight for? And this dilemma is different in different places. So for example, you cannot be simply anti-nationalist in a region that doesn't enjoy proper national sovereignty or when its society is being destroyed by colonial forces, for example. So how you think of nationalism in this region is very different from how you think of it in the United States. The question of race in the United States is different from the question of racism in the Arab world. So this is not a universal imagined future, but I think there is a serious dilemma because people seriously are struggling to think of what can work and what cannot work. So, and I myself, this is why I said it has to be a collective vision.
And
unfortunately, a lot of times, for whatever reason, that is also missing. We do have neoliberal ways of thinking about visions, even within radical thought. And I don't have an answer to that myself, but you know, it's something we all have to think about.
And I'm really happy to hear that you sort of concluded by saying that it is about a collective vision and that you can have your own vision, and but that vision is actually deeply linked to collectives, but it's also deeply linked to a politics of anti-colonialism and anti-imperialism and anti-capitalism and, you know, and taking down patriarchy. So yeah, I think that's a beautiful way to end this conversation. I want to thank you, Hisham, for your really, really important insights and the amazing work that you do. For those that want to check out Hisham's book, it's called Banking on the State, The Financial Foundations of Lebanon. I'm sending so much strength, revolutionary rage, and solidarity from Toronto. Shukran ektir, Hisham.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure, and it's been also an honor to be in conversation with you. And I want to wish you all the best with all the wonderful work, the critical work that you're producing. And I also send my regards to everybody in Toronto. Again, your listeners, some of them may know, I spent quite some time myself in the city and I miss the people.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. If you'd like to learn more and engage with us, please check us out at www.liberationpedagogyproject.com and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.